I was listening to the NPR radio program Writer's Almanac last week, and Billy Collins read a part of Walt Whitman's preface to The Leaves of Grass that kind of sounded like the Metta Sutta. So I thought I'd bring it for no good reason other than to share it, and another interpretation of the Metta Sutta. This is what you shall do. Love the earth and the sun and the animals. Despise riches. Give alms to everyone that asks. Devote your income and labor to others. Hate tyrants. Argue not concerning God. Have patience and indulgence toward people. Take off your hat to nothing known or unknown, or to anyone. Go freely with powerful, uneducated people. I wonder what that means. And with young mothers of families. Read these leaves, meaning, I think, his book of poems, in the open air every year of your life. Re-examine all you have been told in school or church or in any book. Dismiss what insults your soul, and your very flesh shall be a great poem and have the richest fluency, not only in its words, but in the silent lines of your lips and face, and between the lashes of your eyes, and in every motion and joint of your body. I thought that was pretty good, even the parts that I didn't quite understand. And actually that last part, where it all gets percolated in the body, reminded me of Catherine and her great instructions on practice with the body. So our conventional self, this thing that we can touch, this ego, this personality that we're so familiar with, has a tendency to get stuck on things, kind of like Velcro. We easily get stuck. Things get easily stuck to us. Little barbs, I think of, you know, that we can't go through the world very easily without just these little feelers reaching out and attaching, getting stuck. And our very practice is to get to know where we get stuck, what we hold on to, what we reject. This very body, you know, nothing else, but getting to know this body and mind. Of course, in Dogen's Genjo Koan, it's the study of Buddhism itself. The study of Buddhism is the study of this very self. And to forget the self is to be awakened by the 10,000 things, the 10,000 things that are all around you, that the universe is directing in your way. to forget the self, to really know when you've gotten caught, when you've gotten stuck, and to somehow let that go. And that might be a hard thing, but and we might not be able to let it go even when we identify it pretty closely where we're stuck. We might stay stuck for a while, but if we're open to just saying, there I am again, stuck, we're loosening that grip a little bit each time. So it's a pretty subtle practice. I mean, we get, you know, just naming things, just saying this or that, just saying right shoe or left shoe separates the world into different pieces and separates the world away from ourselves. So it's pretty subtle, these barbs, our tendency to get stuck and to separate the world into pieces that we might reject or grasp onto. So it's a pretty subtle practice, and it's a practice that we do over and over again. There's never an empty place where we can say, you know, I let it all go. I'm done with that practice. It'll come up again in the next breath. And that's our willingness to keep this body and mind of practice coming back to it is what we do, is what we practice on the cushion. It's what we practice as we walk out of here to get tea tonight. We'll practice it leaving the Zendo and getting back home. We can do it again and again with every breath. It's pretty obvious when we're sitting in here meditating. We were going over the meditation posture with Pew Yu last night, sitting up straight, knees crossed, hands in the lap. Reb Anderson says in his book, Being Upright, we've got an upright practice. Can we just for this breath be upright in our lives, not shying away from the things that we don't like so much, not bobbing back and forth to avoid things, not leaning forward, reaching out towards the things we like, but just for this breath, can we be upright in the world just the way it is? One body, one world, one mind, no separation. Chanted last night, Song of the Trusting Mind. The great way is not difficult for those who hold no preferences. What did we say that other translation was? The great way isn't... Just stop picking and choosing. Something about picking and choosing. When longing and aversion are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. So that addresses how very subtle this practice is, the smallest distinction in this and that. Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. Move and you are trapped. Miss and you fall into doubt and vacillation. Turning away and touching are both wrong, for it's like a massive fire. So there's no great place to rest. If you hold on to that fire too tightly, you'll get burnt. If you reject that fire of your life too much, the fire will spread and more trouble will follow. So where can you settle down? Turning and touching away are both wrong. So I've been caught. I've been touching the world of work a lot. Maybe some of you saw my picture in the newspaper where I was espousing the cause of the physicians' union at work. So I've done this for several years, been part of the negotiation team for the contracts that come up. And I try to bring practice into that environment. I've got my ideas about how our contract should go, what it should say. But it's pretty easy to vilify the people on the other side of the table, the negotiating table. I mean, the fact that there's a table and the union sits on one side and the personnel department sits on another side, it's pretty graphic. It manifests duality. And, one of the negotiators from the county, one of the personnel department, who has a very different idea about our contract, drops her son off to school across the street, and we wave to each other all the time. And it's very different, you know. I try to remember that. That this very person that has such a different idea that I do is, I see all the time, right across the street from the Zen Center. And it feels a lot different. So I try to bring that in. But when the newspaper is there interviewing me and snapping shots, I think I say the party line. I think I don't say, she's a nice lady. Her son does great in school. I hope her side wins. I have to watch myself. And it's a difficult practice. Lots of emotions come up. And my union brothers and sisters, I find myself really wanting them to like me, so I get reinforced if I hold a position. But I get stuck a lot. And so that's the practice that I do. in my touching practice. I've touched it, and I can tell when I'm stuck. And I think the song of the jewel mirror samadhi is right. Touching and turning away are both wrong. So a few weeks ago I was vacationing with an old friend and at his place in Chicago. And in addition to canoeing on Lake Michigan, hiking the trails of Sleeping Bear Dunes National Park, we also finished up the trip going out to dinner in Chicago. And we were walking back to the car after dinner. And we passed this bar that had a big open area patio, lots of people that we wandered past on our way to the car. And wandering through there, somebody said, gays aren't welcome here. And I was stuck. There's an exercise that you're taught in nonviolent communication, you know, where you kind of express your feelings in a non-judgmental way, and you make requests of the other person. But I wasn't in that space. I was just stuck. You know, I can put words to it now. I mean, I was fearful. I was angry and surprised. I, you know, really felt like I was a victim. And but it was all pretty wordless. It was just this frozen body. And I turned and I really wasn't able to identify where it came from. Nobody was raising their hands. And, you know, I was relieved, you know, because I was, you know, what would I have done? I was really confused. You can put that on another one, another feeling or another state. I was confused. And we just walked away. My friend said he didn't hear anything because, you know, definitely I was, at some point I was, you know, got my words back and wanted to talk. And you know, I'm still stuck. I'm still stuck, you know, what would have been the best response. I really felt like that was the turning away, although, you know, I'm stuck. That was the turning away, but, you know, I'm holding on to something. I'm holding on to, you know, it tapped into, you know, these other barbs, you know, my own kind of internalized homophobia. You know, maybe I shouldn't be welcome. My own fears of being discovered. All of that was triggered. Those are barbs that you know are out there waiting for something to attach to them. And so it wasn't even the barbs in the moment, but just those few words brought back, you know, 60 years of stuff, of Velcro, of all the Velcro that's developed. So I don't think that was the right response either. So that was, you know, I can feel in my body both the turning away and touching are both wrong. It's like a massive fire. What does Dogen say? Dogen says the same thing. Grasping and flowers fall. Turning away and weed spread. So there it was. The Lotus Sutra gives us a practice that a person can start a few days later when their wits are with them. The practice of saying, you're a Buddha. You're a great teacher. You will have you'll be the next Buddha. You'll have many Buddha fields. And to look at everyone and identify them as the next Buddha. And that helps a little bit. We've got an archetype, Bodhisattva, Samantabhadra, who really looks at the big picture and says, yep, there's a lot of work to do. There's no time like the present, but it's a big job. And, you know, Patrick, you cover Chicago. You've got Chicago. And, you know, I think we've got Santa Cruz covered pretty well. So, you know, let's move on to Sacramento and we'll get the Sacramento Zen Center out there. And so we've got the Bodhisattva Samantabhadra, who really, you know, has a plan, a long-term plan to save all beings, and it's going to take some time, but we've got a plan. So I can get back into that body. But you know, Dao Wu went to the doctor, and his story of going to the doctor was told in case number 83 of the Blue Cliff of the Book of Serenity. His Dharma brother Guishan says, "Where have you been?" And Dao Wu says, "I've been to the doctor." Guishan says, "Were there a lot of sick people there?" And Dao Wu said, "Some people were sick, and some people were not sick." And Guishan asks, "Were you one of the people that weren't sick? Dao Wu, were you one of the people that weren't sick, that wasn't sick?" And Dao Wu said, "You know, sick or not sick, that's not really the point. So Guishan, tell me what do you think about this?" And Guishan said, "You know, thinking and speaking about it isn't the point either." So this is another lesson on, you know, we start off trying to find out where we're stuck And that's the only practice we can do. That's where we start this practice. Where am I stuck? Oh, here it is again. I'm stuck again. We do that over and over. And we can, you know, relax into that. We can say, okay, I don't need to hold on to this idea so tightly. I can say to the personnel team, well, I can think about that. Let me and my team huddle about this, and we'll think about your proposal. So I can release my grip on the things that I'm stuck with, and we can compromise. Another way of saying that is, I can let go of my grip on this self a little bit, and become more intimate with the things around me. When I'm not so stuck in this self, already things are closer to me. I can do that. But Dao Wu and his Dharma friend Guishan are saying, even identifying the world into this and that, you've got to take a look at that a little bit. And when we're sitting here in Zazen, when we're just saying, I can sit here for one more breath. We're inhabiting this body and mind completely. Nothing else. No other body and mind. And we're inhabiting this one universe completely. And then it's not so much inside and outside this body. It's just this experience of being right here. And I think that's the practice of it's not about sick or not sick, or it's not about talking or not talking. It's just about inhabiting this one body and mind. It's about joining this universe and not grasping it or rejecting it. And as I said before, this is a practice we do with every breath, not just at the cushion, but at work in Chicago. The whole works. So maybe others of us have practiced this way, or others of us have been thrown to one side of the tracks or the other. Or some of us have fled to our neutral corners as fast as we could. And how have we practiced with that? Kathy.
One of the things I'm learning in this practice is that I think part of the Velcro glomming tendency is we lump everything together. And there's something very helpful about kind of allowing it to loosen and actually look at the different parts and don't think they necessarily have to be connected in the way that we've been connecting and that we're holding on to. You know, the story is kind of a way that we tell it, and it has to be this way. And I'm imagining in your role, with the labor negotiation, because I watched labor negotiations work as a neutral person, and I've just seen how difficult it is if both sides feels like their job is to cling and never let go of anything, then nothing can ever happen. But when the pieces start falling, getting a little bit of space in between them, then I'm finding, you know, there's actually like, okay, this piece, no, not this one, but this one, well, maybe, let's talk about it. Or, well, this one, well, maybe not exactly the way you're saying it, but how about if it was this way? And it starts getting, it starts moving. It starts, there starts being some flow. And then I think that something unexpected can happen. It couldn't have happened as long as we thought the answer was to stay in our bunkers and fire salvos at each other. You know? So that's one personal experience I've been having, and I also can't resist telling you, I was listening to NPR coming over, and I thought of you, because I know you're an opera buff, and apparently Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg, who argue on the opposite sides, it's Mr. Arch-Conservative against Ms. Super-Liberal, and they're always arguing, and this guy started to hear it as opera, and he actually wrote an opera of Scalia and Ginsburg singing their arguments and invited them to come to the debut performance because they are both opera buffs. That's their unity, is they argue in court and they go to the opera together. So they went to this opera and got to hear these musicians singing them in their positions. And I thought, that's something kind of interesting.
Because
I just couldn't resist sharing that.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
I don't know if that's helpful or not.
No, it is.
You never know.
It's a good story. I mean, your point is, I think, we've got common ground. And as a matter of fact, on one extreme, there is no difference between any of us.
Yeah.
And I was thinking when you were talking, can Buddhists be on a jury? You know, if you got called for jury duty, you know, would you be able to just, when they got to asking you things, would you just say, Your Honor, you know, I'm for the unity of all things. You know, there's no guilt. It's not about guilt or innocence. Yeah. So, you know, can we go into a voting booth? Just. How can we pick and choose in this practice? I mean, I think you're right. We can go into voting booths.
But I don't know about the jury.
Richard.
A couple of things. The jury, I think, to go into, if you thought that you weren't going to judge somebody, but if you were going to see it in your judgment, they were safe to be among the public, or maybe they needed to be supervised or gotten help, which would be different than saying you're right or wrong, we're going to put you in the penitentiary. I totally agree. If you start following the Buddhist idea, you don't belong on a jury, but maybe there's a reason you could be of some service there. I had a thought about the negotiating thing, which of course I'm sure you're a thousand times better at than I am. But my idea is when I get into something that looks like a negotiation, the first thing I would ask, and I might not get agreement on this, but I would say is, I'd like us, all of us, and the whole negotiating group, not to be two teams, but to be one team looking at a common project where we're going to find out what's best for everybody. You know, and if they'll agree to that, you have a starting point. It doesn't mean anything's going to happen, but that's become a practice of mine. It's the idea of negotiating. And really, it's the only way it's going to work if everybody looks at, well, okay, we need to compromise, but what will be the best for everyone here? agree at least to sit with that idea. I think that's an interesting way to start.
No. Yeah, that is.
Also, just, you know, one other, it's not possible to explain how much I appreciate you talking about your personal experiences. You know, we all have them. I have them all the time. You get stuck with them. And the only thing that comes to my mind is, I mean, I would ask you this because I have a person in my heart that when those things happen, I mean, it could be Buddha, but I have someone else, another teacher, I think, of who I always say, after I can think about it, well, what would they say? And I know exactly what they would say. In your case, it would be, I would wonder, I suppose I would take Catherine to be certainly an important teacher to you. What do you think she would have done in that situation?
I just don't know. You know, there's causes, like I say, causes and conditions of the moment, causes and conditions of, you know, the 60 years of, you know, Velcro building. And it's hard to know what would come out at any moment. Yeah. Thank you. Stan.
Now I have to go on the left side of the stove, and we're seeing what is the most appropriate place to put them, because the kitchen has a different layout. So it's a new situation, but we have our old paradigms, and we're struggling. But we're trying to keep an open mind and some humor about it. Realizing, well, I used to go there, and what's the best place for it? Really, same thing what we're talking about. What's the best place for this? For the scratch lift, for instance. The left side of the stove, or right? And so we're starting to, you know, as we cook meals, well, where should this go now? And then letting that drive where it actually ends up rather than what we're used to.
Thank you. Lori.
During my last experience with Jury Duty, I made it through a number of the processes, and in the very last cut, the judge looked at me and asked, could I separate the decision of the jury from the consequences of the decision of the jury? I said, no. That sounded completely crazy to me. He had some kind of unkind things to say about that, about my response, and dismissed me. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a symptom of how our system is broken.
Yeah.
That he would even ask that question.
Yeah.
But that's how our system works, mm-hmm. I guess. To the extent that it does. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's like I say there, the initial request of him was, you know, which side are you on? And so it does seem like that duality is part of the system. And no, that's a tough one. Gene.
There's one great advantage to being hard of hearing, and that is when comments occur, such as you heard in Chicago, they just float right on by. They don't land.
Yeah.
You know, they don't completely have the same impact.
Yeah.
And I have in my life heard such comments, and I know how painful that is. So, partly, knowing that if I could hear and did hear, a person is saying, as we know from therapeutic context, they're saying more about themselves than they are about you. You know. So partly where I can go is that person must be suffering, so to make such a comment,
mm-hmm.
and kind of. Offer that generosity. Will you be free from suffering? Will may you be free from suffering? Simultaneous, though, with the feeling completely the pain of the impact of a comment like that or physical action like that. And I think in practice we want to think that the benevolence of will maybe be free from suffering is separate and different from, ow, that hurt, you know. But the truth is, both of those feelings can exist simultaneously and completely.
Mm-hmm.
Acknowledge the pain that that is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, homophobia is really messed up. And fully express that simultaneous with, may this person be free of their suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, well, that's... And the story in the Lotus Sutra, of course, is, you know, this was a monk, a bodhisattva, who did this practice all the time. And so it was right there on the front burner of his experience. And that's an intention of mine is to have that mind of practice be right there on the front burner. And we can, you know, cultivate that intention, you know, with our sitting here, with mindfulness practice, and so that we, you know, we can be that bodhisattva who as the words are still hanging in the air, we see those as, the words of the future Buddha. So you're right. My friend who didn't hear the comment, you know, well, he when we talked about it, he certainly, you know, I got him to share my outrage. but it was a little different. You know, he didn't have that surprise element. He was already, you know, in the problem solving mode. You know, he didn't have to go through the other stages. He did, I'm still kind of hanging on with. And of course, you know, he was singing opera right there with me. But his experience was a little different just by the causes and conditions of it being just a little different. So it's a big complicated world and that's why our practice, why we have to, keep that vow, keep that intention of having practicing right there in front of us all the time. Thank you. May we vow to sit with our lives and accept and be grateful for the 10,000 things. Beings are numberless. I love them.